More Texans out and about over the weekend as the governor makes moves to reopen the Texas economy. What's next and the implications for safety? Today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Despite steps to get back to business, no end in sight for a return to normalcy. We'll talk about steps to stay mentally well under stay-at-home guidelines. Bankruptcy protections for a high-end Texas-based retailer, an echo of the culture wars or the end of an era? It's one thing to cut a student-athlete from a roster, but to cut whole teams? A new normal spreads across Texas higher ed. Those stories and more when the Standard gets going right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 27th day of April, 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. In Colleyville, Texas, about a 30-minute drive northwest of Dallas, the scenes were like something from a movie circa, I don't know, spring 2019? People sitting in the sun under umbrellas at outdoor cafes, enjoying lunch and each other's company. As Colleyville became the first city in Texas to relax restrictions on non-essential businesses, there were reports of Texans traveling from the other side of the Metroplex just to get a taste of normalcy. Let's hit the rewind button. It was only last month, horror stories on the TV news shows. A 39-year-old coronavirus victim found dead on her kitchen floor in New York City. Big Apple filled with fear and foreboding as COVID-19 numbers spiraled seemingly out of control. We are your future, Governor Andrew Cuomo ominously warned the nation. Where New York is today, you will be in 3 to 4 weeks, he said. That was on March 24th. It has been more than 3 to 4 weeks. New York is much better now, and for the record, Texas isn't anywhere close to where New York was. Among the 50 states and the District of Columbia, Texas ranks 41st per million persons when it comes to COVID-19 deaths, and hospital capacity easily outstrips demand despite the worst predictions. It would be easy to get smug about all this, and Governor Abbott seems to know it, but he is also too careful a politician not to know that the moves he's taking could be the most consequential of his time so far as governor, to say nothing of the life and death implications for people in the Lone Star State. If the eyes of the nation were on Georgia this weekend, as that state lifted many restrictions, they're turning to Texas long about now, as Jonathan Tylove reports for the Austin American-Statesman, where he is chief political writer. Jonathan, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the governor's moves to reopen the Texas economy, and we should preface this with the fact that he has a news conference scheduled for this Monday afternoon, so we are talking about the situation as we go to air on a Monday morning. What is your understanding about how the governor wants to reopen the economy in Texas?
Well, clearly the devil in this case really will be in the details, and the governor has both set expectations and tried to tamp down expectations as he moves toward this consequential news conference. He said that a wide array of businesses will be reopened in some fashion under some rules, well beyond the essential businesses that are currently allowed to be open. At the same time, he said he will be guided by the data and the doctors, and that the worst thing that could happen, worse than a tardy reopening, would be to reopen, see a significant spike in the spread of COVID, and have to shut down again.
I can recall a couple of weeks ago reporting here that based on statistics and experts from the University of Texas at Austin and others, that we would be hitting a peak in early May when it came to the impact of the coronavirus in Texas. Is that no longer considered to be the case? Is that why these steps are being taken now? Or is it he's getting so much pressure, political pressure from the right? Or what is happening?
Well, it's a bit of both. I think that he looks at the peaks for deaths and for the spread as being earlier in May, and that he's got a couple weeks that have not reached that peak again. At the same time, both those metrics have inched up in the last few days, so it's not an absolutely crystal clear pattern of what's happening. You know, I think he's not going to do anything that's going to take effect immediately, so we're talking another week or so before anything would begin to happen, and then maybe it'll be staged from there. I think the idea is to try to create a system that will be able to kind of leap into situations where it appears to be resurging and really kind of do testing beyond what they've been able to do before and tracing and tracking people.
Are you hearing any details? I mean, I mentioned what was happening in Georgia, allowing gyms, hair salons, barbershops, tattoo parlors, and bowling alleys to reopen, but maintaining social distancing and sanitation guidelines. In Texas, any hints about what might happen?
Well, there's where there's been some mixed messaging. You know, Governor Kemp in Georgia went ahead and did that, seemingly with the encouragement of President Trump. And as soon as he did it, President Trump belittled him for doing it and criticized him and said he wasn't pleased with him. So it's dangerous terrain. And I think that Abbott has said that he agreed that Kemp went too far too fast and went to things like the tattoo parlors and the salons that were the most likely to spread infection, and then that was a mistake. At the same time, the governor was asked, I guess it was on talk radio in Dallas on Thursday, you know, when can I tell my wife I'm going to take her to dinner and a movie? And the governor said, well, we just need to give those restaurants and movie theaters about a week to get ready. Well, I think people are going to be pretty reluctant to take advantage of dining in restaurants. So I understand the impulse to want to get the economy moving in a way that allows people to continue to or to start to draw paychecks again. But I don't think that there's a real demand among Texans or people elsewhere to get back to the kind of intimate surroundings that seem really risky.
Jonathan Tylove is chief political writer for the Austin American Statesman, and we've been speaking in advance of the governor's expected news conference on Monday afternoon. If you want to read the latest, go over to statesman.com. Thanks so much for talking with us, Jonathan. Good to have you back on the broadcast.
Thanks very much.
There was a tweet that was repeated by most media outlets. There was the media uproar, and then there was the actual proclamation. And as often happens, the tweet and the media uproar are about something very different from what actually ends up in the proclamation that follows several days later. The tweet in question is one in which the president talks about an invisible enemy and says he will temporarily suspend immigration into the United States. But now, what's actually been ordered? Joining us now is Kate Lincoln Goldfinch. She specializes in immigration cases, and she's an attorney based out of Central and South Texas. Ms. Lincoln Goldfinch, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me on.
Let's talk a little bit about the first tweet so that we have a frame of reference here. And I'm going to quote from Donald Trump's tweet from April 20th. In light of the attack from the invisible enemy, capitalized, as well as the need to protect the jobs of our great American citizens, I will be signing an executive order to temporarily suspend immigration into the United States. Has immigration been suspended into the United States?
I would say it hasn't. The actual order had a far fewer teeth than the tweet did. What it did was suspend immigrant visa processing at the consulates abroad for the next 60 days.
That sounds rather different. Well, it's my understanding that the purpose of this was to, what, protect unemployed Americans during COVID-19, as we, 26 million Americans now jobless. Was that the purpose of this proclamation?
Well, that was certainly what the president suggested in his tweet. But in fact, these immigrant visas, most of them are family members of U.S. citizens and permanent residents. And there are some people who are getting immigrant visas through employment, but that is a smaller percentage.
Let's talk about the proclamation, because you can make a case that the tweet is one thing, the proclamation is another, right?
Yeah, and this follows a pattern that we've seen multiple times under President Trump, where I believe he tries to distract us from something else that is going on and tries to inflame his base and put something anti-immigrant out there. And then when he actually consults his advisors and has to put the order into effect, realize that he has, you know, less authority than he threatened to have in his tweet.
So what exactly do you see as the purpose for the tweet then? Election year politicking?
Absolutely. I think it was meant to inflame his base and continue his anti-immigrant rhetoric and perhaps to distract all of us from the failure of leadership regarding the pandemic.
I was taking a look at what some other Western democracies have been doing, and what the United States is doing isn't really that far out of line with what countries from France to Belgium to Italy to Greece, and it seems like, in fact, the only country that has taken a more pro-immigrant stand in Europe, certainly, was Portugal, which stands alone in a sense of sort of opening its doors to immigrants, at least during the COVID-19 crisis. Do you see the United States as being out of step with other Western liberal democracies?
Well, I think, you know, the consulates are already closed to interviews, and they may very well be for the next 60 days. So this order may not actually impact cases at all, because these interviews may not have happened in the first place. So I think this is really more about the politicking, as you say, than an actual impact on immigration policy.
Bottom line, how many people do you think in Texas are going to be affected by an order like this, or are people being directly affected right now?
I think it's a very small percentage. The thing to keep in mind is that people who are inside the United States immigrating will not be impacted. People who are applying for green cards, for work permits, for citizenship, although those interviews are being delayed because of COVID, this order will not impact those cases. This order only applies to people who are applying for immigrant visas at the U.S. consulates outside of the United States. And many people are exempted from the order.
Kate Lincoln Goldfinch specializes in immigration law. She's an attorney in Central and South Texas. Ms. Lincoln Goldfinch, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Take care.
Monitoring social media on this Monday, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hi there, Wells.
Hi, David. Good to hear you. We're hearing about Governor Greg Abbott's anticipated announcement concerning the reopening of Texas businesses. Via Facebook, Gibby Timlitz calls it way too soon. Over 55,000 dead so far since March nationwide, and 23,000 plus infected in Texas with very limited testing. Look at Georgia for a glimpse into our near future, he writes. Kimberly Claiborne writes that reopening isn't going to last long. It isn't going to work out, she predicts. They have too much faith in Americans actually following guidelines, while she notes that many haven't even been following them this whole time. However, Jordan Peterson says the governor's gradual approach is just right. We aren't throwing the door open. Also, many more comments coming in via Twitter. I'll be back with more of those on the show, plus other stories from social media, David.
We'd love to hear what you think of the governor's move to sort of take it slow but begin the reopening process. Tweet us, won't you, at Texas Standard. Wells back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. This time last week, we told you Reuters was reporting Dallas-based upscale retailer Neiman Marcus could soon declare bankruptcy. The story was picked up by many other outlets last week. But Neiman's troubles aren't so much a consequence of COVID-19 as of other trends running counter to those that have long made Neiman's a shorthand for Texas-sized wealth and consumption. KERA's Brett Jaspers reports.
This music is from Frederick Wiseman's 1983 documentary on Neiman Marcus called simply The Store. As maybe the premier luxury buying experience, Neiman's has long been a cultural touchstone, from mainstream sitcoms like Golden Girls.
The wagons will be here momentarily to transport all of you downtown.
Downtown? He means jail!
Oh, really, Rose? I thought he meant Neiman Marcus.
To HBO's Girls, where aspiring writer Hannah takes an embarrassing job writing magazine advertorials.
So, who's the sponsor?
Neiman Marcus.
Neiman Marcus?
Do you think I'm excited, Ray?
The store's fame and notoriety didn't come just because it sold expensive stuff. A visit to Neiman Marcus was a unique and enthralling experience.
Even for a child, it was a magical place. It was a total kind of a wonderland.
Tracy Aker Hayes is former fashion editor at the Dallas Morning News and also did two stints working for Neiman Marcus. Hayes said Neiman Marcus, founded in 1907, rose to prominence because it was a high-end place to shop in a huge state overflowing with oil money. Fashion seekers with cash came from all over, helping put Dallas on the radar of any designer with national or international business.
They would all note Dallas as a magnet for fashion and a place that's important to their business.
Hayes also credits the creativity of Stanley Marcus, son of one of the founders. Tom Alexander wrote a book about Marcus and also worked for him as the company's head of marketing.
A New Yorker article one time said he was the first one to sell the sizzle before he sold the merchandise. I think that's very true.
Neiman Marcus has temporarily closed all its 43 stores and furloughed thousands of workers. Moody's and Standard & Poor's recently downgraded the company's credit rating. A big cause is that Neiman Marcus has almost $5 billion of debt. Sales were up and down in recent years, but experts say even decent sales can mean little when you have so much debt. Basically, there just isn't leftover money to invest in the company. Neiman Marcus declined comment. Jacqueline Thomas is a professor at SMU's Cox School of Business. She said Neiman's luxury brand gives it a chance to bounce back from money problems.
Its brand is not driven just simply by its name itself. It's also driven by the items and services that it offers to its potential consumers.
Customers of fancy stores like Neiman Marcus go there for exclusive products or personalized service. The word bankruptcy doesn't necessarily change that. And the immediate shift to online buying during COVID-19 may not be a death knell either.
These different platforms, whether it's the brick-and-mortar platform, whether it's the online platform, or back in the day it was the catalog platform, they actually operate synergistically as opposed to in isolation.
Government research from last year says over 80% of retail shopping was still done in-store. Tracy Aker Hayes says the parent company of Saks Fifth Avenue has been interested in buying Neiman Marcus, and this might be the opening.
Of course, that would break my heart, as anybody who grew up in Dallas or Texas, I think, to see Neiman's absorbed.
Saks Neiman Marcus just doesn't have the same sizzle. I'm Brett Jaspers.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Give us some good news. Come on. How about this one? U.S. gasoline demand has hit the lowest since the Vietnam War. I guess that's good if you're a consumer for sure, but things could start to turn around soon. Let's turn to Matt Smith. Matt is Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data, of course. Matt, good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you, David.
When we got started here, you said that you do have some good data for us.
Yeah, I've got some good news from around the world from the perspective of how things are starting to get back to normal a little bit.
All right.
So, for example, in Europe, we're seeing a rebound in electricity demand there. So even though a lot of those major economies are lagging well below normal, sort of down as much as 25%, we're seeing Italy, France and Spain all bottoming out in the last month, and then Germany in the last couple of weeks as well. But then also in China as well, where this kind of all kicked off, we're getting signs there that refining activity has rebounded strongly in April as their economy opens back up and people go back to work again. One interesting thing, though, with that, David, is that more people are driving as well because they don't want to take the public transport. So that's
interesting.
That side.
That is interesting. People not wanting to get on public transport because of the fear of proximity to other passengers, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's obviously something that we're going to have to watch here as well with the particularly, you know, with New York once that gets back up and running. But gasoline demand, though, here in the US in recent weeks, it's dropped basically by about half to around 5 million barrels a day. Yeah. That said, though, it appears to have leveled off in the last week or so, and demand is gradually starting to tick back up a little bit. But that said, it seems that this minor rebound points more to quarantine fatigue than a sign of the economy opening back up. So people are just going out and just driving just because they're sick of being stuck at home.
Yeah, I
totally understand that, and I think a lot of people have some firsthand experience with a little bit of that here in Texas. I think something that a lot of people are keeping their eyes on, they've noticed, they've seen the pictures from satellites showing that there's a whole lot less pollution in the big cities across the United States and around the world with so many people on lockdown. You have increase in energy consumption, good on that sort of macroeconomic level, but in other ways, maybe not so good unless we're looking to perhaps newer, cleaner energy sources. Any sign that that sort of thing is happening or not so much?
Not so much immediately right now. I think everyone's just very short-termist and trying to deal with the current crisis. But as we come out of this, it's going to be interesting to see if there is a mindset change, you know. But at the same time here as well, when you consider the US, we've seen 26 million people lose their jobs in the last 5 weeks. And so, you know, we're not going to get back to the pre-coronavirus levels anytime soon, whether it's from an energy demands perspective, from an economic perspective. We may not do from an environmental perspective and pollution's perspective, too. So there's always that silver lining, I suppose.
And here in Texas, of course, this has had such a huge impact in an industry that's pretty critical to the Lone Star State and its budget. Do you see any rebound occurring there? I mean, as you look at the demand and refining activity.
A rebound in the refining activity for sure, as we see gasoline demand rebounding in that. But in terms of production, no, we're going to be going lower. So, you know, just a month or so ago, we were at 13 million barrels per day. We're probably closer to 12 now, and that's going to continue to drop by a few more million barrels per day from here, just given low prices and the impact that has on the industry.
What are the experts saying, by the way, in terms of price per barrel right now? I mean, where is West Texas Intermediate at the moment, and what are the projections?
Well, we're about $15 a barrel here. It's coming off strongly today. And until we see demand really rebounding to mop up that supply, we're going to stay at low price environment here for a while.
Matt Smith is Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data. Good to chat with you again, Matt, and have a great week.
You too as well. Thanks, David. Take care.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A youth soccer coach injured in last year's mass shooting at an El Paso Walmart has died. KERA's Mallory Falk reports the death toll now stands at 23.
Guillermo Memo Garcia was outside the Cielo Vista Walmart on August 3rd, helping fundraise for the El Paso Fusion soccer team. He was shot multiple times and remained at the hospital nearly 9 months until his death over the weekend, the last remaining patient hospitalized since the shooting. In a statement, Del Sol Medical Center CEO David Shimp said, quote, "His courage, his strength, and his story have touched many lives, including those of our caregivers who tirelessly fought with him and for him every step of the way. We are grieving with his family and with our community," end quote. The August shooting was the deadliest attack on Latinos in modern U.S. history. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
A group representing more than 420 banks in Texas expects the latest round of funding for the Paycheck Protection Program to be used up in a matter of days. Congress last week approved roughly $320 billion to replenish the Small Business Administration loan program. The federal dollars are available as of today. Chris Furlow is president and CEO of the Texas Bankers Association. He expects the funding to go quickly because the application process will run more smoothly this time around.
When SBA launched the PPP in round one, their tech platform was not ready for the volume, and the government guidance was very much incomplete. In round two, you'll have more lenders, and some of the round one kinks on the government side should be worked out.
During the first round of PPP funding, Texas led the nation in the number of small business loans approved, with more than 134,000. Houston officials are distributing face masks to help residents comply with a Harris County order requiring them to be worn in public places for the next 30 days. The directive took effect today. Mayor Sylvester Turner announced last Friday city council members have been provided with masks for their constituents and will be handing them out this week.
we'll be distributing well over 50,000 additional masks.
A conservative political activist is challenging Harris County's face mask requirement in court. And couples throughout the country are turning to virtual platforms to hold their weddings while social distancing measures remain in place. That includes Nina and Mario Olivares in Corpus Christi. Judge David Stith officiated the ceremony via Zoom over the weekend.
Mario, will you have this woman to be your wedded wife?
I will.
Nina, will you have this man to be your wedded husband?
That audio is courtesy of the Corpus Christi Caller Times. About 40 guests tuned in to the call, including one in Germany. It was Judge Stith's second online wedding. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Social distancing, shelter in place, quarantine, lockdown. There's a common theme, even bigger than COVID-19 here. Isolation. When it comes to mental health, the additional loss of physical connection to people in the outside world could bring some to a breaking point or close to it. Joining us now is Dr. Rita Walker. She's clinical psychologist and professor at the University of Houston. Dr. Walker, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
Something that a lot of us have been hearing about is how the term social distancing should be changed to physical distancing. What do you make of that argument and the significance of that?
I agree with that 100%. And one of the things that I have been saying to people is that social distancing doesn't mean social exclusion. So we can still find ways to connect meaningfully with others without saying we're completely isolated. Because, yes, I do think that when we think of this as, oh, I can't have any connection to others, that adds to some of our mental health strain.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because we've heard about virtual happy hours and virtual dance parties and virtual concerts and movie screenings. What's missing from those virtual experiences? And does it have the same benefits as being physically present?
They're not the same. We're living in a very different time, a very different circumstance in which we are forced to be creative. But if we can be in the moment in those experiences, so enjoy the virtual Zumba class and the virtual happy hours, but don't minimize or undermine those experiences by saying, well, it's not the same, or it doesn't have much meaning. That is certainly true, but if we can focus on what it does mean, yes, I do get to connect with these individuals and not have to force myself to say, get dressed, to deal with traffic, and think about the benefits of what it means to have virtual experiences.
You know, I know this, you know, the saying, no one's an island, and yet there are a lot of people who don't really mind spending time on their own. There are a lot of people who actually are enjoying working from home right now. So not everything is equal for all people, of course, but I'm wondering how much of a factor loneliness is for folks right now and how it ranks among other stresses, you know, job loss, food insecurities, past due rents, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because it's true that not everyone is struggling right now. There are those among us who are happy to be secluded at home. But for those of us who, like I said, we kind of pile on maybe to our circumstances by saying, you know, I can't get through this, or this is overwhelming and I can't manage this, that if we can try and focus on, okay, let me use my internal coping. So those are the things in us that we can do. And we can focus, as an example, on learning a new skill, taking on a new hobby, or picking up something that we did not do previously that we said we would do, like clean out a closet. Like, these are all things that we can do to invest more so in this time of social distance.
But that requires a certain self-awareness that I'm not sure that everyone may possess. I mean, how do you know what to look out for in yourself if you are struggling? I mean, sometimes we're the last people to know. It's others that see us and comment sometimes, and yet quite often we're by ourselves.
Yeah, and that's the part that is being careful or mindful of our thoughts. I think we do have to start there, that if we're saying things like, I can't get through this for the next few days or weeks or months, focus on the moment. Can I get through the next 15 minutes? And if the answer to that is no, then maybe start journaling, start writing down those thoughts so that we pay attention to the script that's running in our head. And instead say, you know what? I can notice
the leaves on the tree. And this is something that we can do. We talk about mindfulness, you know, starting to be aware and be honest about how we're actually doing.
It's my understanding that there are studies that say that physical touch is vital to one's health. When that's out of the question, for the most part, is there a next best thing?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I can't say that I know, in part because we're living in unprecedented circumstances. And I think we do have to realize that while we may be in a new normal, and we may not ever get back to the way things used to be, that it is still temporary. And we will get to a point where we have human touch and we're able to connect with our loved ones and the people that we care about. It will get here. But in the meantime, we may have to distract ourselves with our virtual activities, you know, just picking up the phone and calling people. You know, we have to get back to some of the things that maybe we used to do that were more meaningful in our relationships that we just haven't had as much opportunity for because our society has gotten to a place where everyone's just ripping and running everywhere.
Dr. Rita Walker is a clinical psychologist and professor at the University of Houston. She's also the director of the Culture, Risk, and Resilience Lab at the university. Dr. Walker, thanks so much for joining us on The Standard.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The coronavirus crisis has inspired many a Texan to reach out to neighbors in need. Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan reports on a San Antonio artist who turned her creativity to the practical.
Like most of us, Ethel Shipton has kept her eyes and ears open through the COVID-19 pandemic. One image in particular she saw just haunted her.
That devastating picture that made the New York Times and the national news of people waiting in line for the food bank. Some people had been waiting in line since 10 o'clock the night before.
And so she suddenly had a brainstorm, lifting from the free library concept.
You know, they had those library boxes that have been around for a long time so that people can take a book and leave a book. Same concept, but with a food box.
She didn't see it as a fix for people in need, but just as something to add to the mix.
It might help a few people. I know that it's not a food bank, but it's maybe a stopgap for a few people, or at least one night a week for somebody.
The one she created is not an amazingly constructed piece of art. Form follows function.
And I've just made it out of scrap wood at my studio. This is a no-brainer. All I need is a screwdriver or a screw gun and a couple of screws.
She decided to call the box For the Taking, and it's mounted at Steeren Street in St. Mary's and Southtown. She wants you to remember that this art has an interactive component.
Hopefully what happens is that people understand that they can take, but other people can also bring who can afford to do that. It's very funny. People leave at least one can so that it's never absolutely empty.
She says she has an additional one built if you have a location for it, and she's ready to build more.
I'm happy to make boxes for people if they are interested in having them.
Shipton says you can contact her on Facebook. She hopes that just as free libraries nourish people's souls, perhaps these food boxes can nourish their bodies. I'm Jack Morgan in San Antonio.
Back when South by Southwest announced it was canceling its mid-March Austin festivals, the risk of coronavirus spread still seemed rather distant somehow. Of course, that's no longer the case. The festivals have a huge economic impact on the Texas capital city and have become a big part of how Austin defines itself. So cancellation was a big deal, to be sure, and it was also a huge letdown to the many who hoped to find their big break being showcased in the fest. But now there's some renewed hope for some filmmakers because, like many other things in this new normal, part of the festival has moved to a virtual venue. Janet Pearson is director of film at South by Southwest. Janet, welcome to Texas Standard.
Thank you. I always love being here.
There's an opportunity now to see some of the films that would have been featured at South by Southwest. Tell us a little bit more about how that's happening, and can anyone take part, or do you need one of the fancy tickets?
Well, what's so great about this program is that anybody who has an Amazon account can watch the films. It's in front of the paywall, so you don't have to pay to see the films, and you don't have to pay to be an Amazon Prime member. You just have to have any kind of Amazon account. It's an opt-in program. It is not the entire South by Southwest 2020 program that we're about to present. We had, you know, 135 features and 120 shorts over the course of 10 days. This is a much smaller sampling, but it's a wonderful, diverse sampling of feature, episodic premieres, and short films that everybody can see starting Monday, April 27th through May 6th. And we've also produced some ancillary Q&As and panel events to, if you want to kind of dive into a little deeper.
Boy, that does sound like a virtual South by Southwest film festival. It must have been pretty challenging to put together, though.
Well, you know, what was interesting, when the event was canceled by the city a week before we were going on, and we're in go mode all year long, you know, and it starts ramping up at Labor Day for real, and it just kind of ramps up higher and higher. You know, there was a lot of momentum, and we knew all the filmmakers who trust us and want to premiere with us, there's a lot at stake. You know, this is a launch for them. It can affect their entire lives and careers. And so the minute we were canceled, we were grateful on the one hand that the health concerns were going to be, you know, diminished or allayed for the city. But then we thought, what about all these filmmakers? What could we do for them? And then Amazon came to us with this idea to invite all the films to participate in front of the paywall for this 10-day event. And it's interesting because a lot of the films that already had other streaming relationships, whether they're on Netflix or Apple or, you know, other films that are big studio films, aren't necessarily going to participate. They're waiting for the theaters to reopen. A lot of films, too, I still have to figure out what their viability is going to be in the commercial marketplace. But the films that opted in knew this was a good opportunity to get in front of a much wider, different audience. They're films that might have gotten lost in the shuffle a little bit. So it's kind of thrilling
to
kind of present them in such a big way.
Yeah, that's all got to go into the calculation that a filmmaker makes. You were talking about opting in to do this. But, you know, you got to think about, okay, well, if I opt in now, maybe I don't get the same kind of buzz as if I hold, you know, if I hold off a little longer. Or, I mean, that's got to be part of the calculus for some of these filmmakers.
It's not buzz. It's actually economic viability. So a lot of the films are looking for distribution and so the fact that we were paying a screening fee to these filmmakers, so they are being rewarded, but it was for a screening fee for a limited online moment, which is different than if you're selling all your rights to somebody to be exposed over a number of years.
Forgive me for asking a personal question, but what sort of emotions have you been wrestling with? Because, you know, you have to cancel the festival and adjust to this new reality. But this is something, as you were saying, you've been building up to for so long.
Oh, every single emotion that there is. I mean, it's been a huge roller coaster. It's been everything. It's adrenaline. It's, you know, devastation. It's been looking for silver linings. It's been everything. And, you know, in a way, the initiatives we've been involved in have helped being a little distracting from the fear of the unknown. I mean, so many people are out of work. The film industry is production stopped by the end of March. No films are being made currently. Movie theaters are closed. That's devastating for somebody like me whose life has been about this for, you know, 40 plus years. So, but it feels great when you take it day by day and you think about being able to share work that you love. Like in the program, these are wonderful films that people are going to be able to see. One of the films, My Darling Vivian, is about Johnny Cash's first wife. None of us know anything about her. And there's all this incredible archive footage of Johnny Cash you haven't seen before. It's great. You know, and interviews with all the daughters. You know, several of them, they're wonderful for all different reasons. Karen Bernstein is a local Texas Austin base, and sometimes she lives outside of Austin, has a film called I'm Gonna Make You Love Me. It's about a man who passes a woman for years in the 70s and 80s, was married in Germany, stationed in Germany, and ended up de-transitioning to live a life as a gay man. Really interesting film. And those are just two. I could go on about each one, but people will get to see them easily.
Janet, I think that there's reason for a lot of people to be excited about what's going to happen with Amazon here. But as you were talking, I began to think, could this evolve into an annual thing, maybe an annual relationship with Amazon?
We will certainly see. We'll see how it goes, and we'll see how much people like it. And, you know, we all have to think outside the box, as I said, in terms of how do we reach our audiences. There is nothing like being in a live situation with strangers and people you know and, the makers right in front of you. And really, that cannot be replaced. But in terms of supporting it, enhancing it, and diversifying, absolutely will be thinking of all the ideas. And we were thrilled when Amazon called up and offered this opportunity, and we'll see how it goes.
Janet Pearson is director of film at South by Southwest. Some of the films from the 2020 festival will be streaming for free on Amazon's Prime Video through May 6th. Janet, thanks again. Nice to talk with you, ma'am.
Thank you so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
Says the Texas Standard, I'm David Brown. Like many of us, college athletes are in limbo right now thanks to COVID-19. Some don't know when their next season will start. Others are unsure whether they'll have a team to play for when they get back on campus, whenever that is. Some schools, including those in Texas, are facing some tough decisions about whether to cut certain sports because of budget shortfalls caused by the pandemic. Here to tell us more, Darren Roberts. He's the founding director of the Center for Sports Leadership and Innovation at the University of Texas at Austin. Darren, welcome back to the Standard.
Dave, always great to be on with you.
St. Edward's University in Austin announced that it would cut six varsity sports because of financial constraints brought on by COVID-19. You think this is just the tip of the iceberg? How do you see this rolling out?
Dave, unfortunately, I do think this is the tip of the iceberg. If you look at the economics of college athletics, for most programs, men's basketball and football are the two sports that in general float the department and essentially help to fund the rest of the sports. I think that a lot of athletic departments across the state and the country are going to be in very similar positions because there's a huge budget shortfall that's coming down the pipe, and there are going to be some tough decisions to be made.
I wonder if there's a difference in how, say, smaller schools are able to weather this storm versus, say, a large institution like UT Austin or even Texas A&M. I mean, you know, on the one hand, you've got these TV contracts. In theory, it's conceivable, I suppose, given the right circumstances, that you could play games without having anyone in a stadium and still get some TV revenue, something like that, right?
Yeah, you know, if you look at most departments, the TV rights deals, the sponsorship money, you know, those really make up the overwhelming majority of the revenue for those programs. And so that's why you're seeing both the NCAA, the NFL, the other major leagues, they're trying to create some sort of TV product. They want something that they can be able to take back to the networks in order to get that revenue from those TV rights deals. For smaller programs, you know, they really don't have the sponsorships and the TV network deals that would allow them to kind of push through a period where you have no attendance and no ticket sales. So it's going to be tough for those mid-tier and lower-tier schools.
Well, speaking of alternate ways of going about things, under normal circumstances, we'd be in the early days of baseball season, Major League Baseball, and the NBA and the NHL would be holding their playoffs right now. It's hard to wrap your head around that when you get to it. What are you hearing about whether and how those leagues might resume play, and can they survive something like this, do you think?
You know, you're seeing some very creative options on the table. You know, people have heard about MLB possibly playing games in the desert in Arizona without any fans, with sort of on-site testing for players. That's been an option. You know, the NFL's kicked around, no fans. This is tough. I mean, this is, you know, people oftentimes use the term unprecedented, and it's usually in times when really it's something we've seen before. We can legitimately say, from a sports perspective, this is an unprecedented moment, and it's going to be very interesting as we get closer and closer to the fall what sorts of solutions the leagues and the teams will generate in order to address this issue.
You think there's an appetite for it, though? I mean, it seems like there's a real hunger, certainly for content. I mean, entertainment content. You'd think that the sports content, there'd be a real demand, too.
Yeah, I think if you look at the viewership for The Last Dance, you know, that was the ESPN series on Michael Jordan. I think that there are a lot of fans who are starving for the content. I'll be honest with you. I think that we're seeing the low point of that demand as we get closer and closer to the fall, especially with football. It is going to be very interesting to see, you know, how that pent-up demand impacts what sorts of creative measures we see coming from the professional leagues.
Darren Roberts is the founding director of the Center for Sports Leadership and Innovation at the University of Texas at Austin. Darren, great to have you on the broadcast. Good as always.
Thank you so much, Dave.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Yeah, social media editor Wells Dunbar has been following what Texans are talking about on this Monday. What are you hearing?
Hi, David. Well, on Twitter, we are at Texas Standard, and there we're hearing a lot more about Governor Greg Abbott's anticipated announcement concerning the reopening of Texas businesses. Here's Ginny from GTX. She tweets that, "I'd sure like to see us get more tests completed first. Texas has been in a perfect position to do testing and tracing properly so we can get back to normal quicker than most. How much do we have in our rainy day fund again?" Referring there to that pot of money in the billions there that the state does indeed
about
possess.
$10 billion right now, yeah.
Yeah. Also, Danny Weir, he tweets us that, "I'm worried about it being too soon also, but a gradual reopening would be a far better strategy than what Georgia has seen. And for goodness sake, don't reopen the beaches and parks yet." Although I think it might be a little too late there on the parks front. Also, we get emails. Linda Wilson writes us, "As long as employers provide protective equipment like masks and gloves and don't force employees to work under unsafe conditions, getting people back to work in a system like ours is crucial enough to take the risk. Hopefully hospitals and governments are finally on the alert so they'll be able to tamp down any hotspots." So obviously no shortage of perspectives out there about what we're going to see coming up today in regards to those guidelines for reopening Texas businesses. Also, if folks want to...
I think some people some practical things, considerations. Getting in an elevator, everyone going to have face masks? How's that all going to work out here?
You know, one thing we're discussing in my household, my wife is self-employed. And so, lots of, as we just heard in this last email, some people saying, putting this sort of onus on the employer. What if you're self-employed? How does that play out? So a whole lot of unanswered questions that, people are going to continue to struggle with even after today. We heard this mentioned in the news roundup earlier in the show that today begins another funding round for the Paycheck Protection Program. That's that Small Business Administration program offering forgivable loans to keep employees on the payroll during the pandemic. That first round of funding went quickly, and large companies that didn't really honor the intent of the law, they obviously courted controversy by taking these loans at that $10 million max. We've heard a lot about that. Even for people that were successful with the program, it hasn't been entirely smooth sailing. On our Facebook page, Brandy Ann Garcia writes, "I'm a small business owner and we applied. We got an email from our bank saying we were approved for funding on the same day initial funding ran out, but that it may take 10 days for the loan to finalize. We've yet to receive those funds, though." So obviously, people watching for that money to appear in their accounts. And I would imagine that what we saw with the demand on that first round of funding, the funds running out in about a week or so, that we could expect to see something similar happen this go around as well.
Well, we'd love to hear how you're dealing with this situation, especially if you're a small business owner, because we've been getting different reports from different parts of Texas. If you are waiting for one of these PPP loans, especially, we would love to hear what your experience has been so far. You know where to find us. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. We're out of time for the big broadcast. The news continues over at texasstandard.org. We'll be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the crew, wishing you a marvelous Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.